Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here, the home studio, Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. And this week, I had the great pleasure of sitting down with Aaron Mankey, podcasting superstar Aaron Mankey of lore fame. Aaron, as it turns out, is a great dude. And I knew this because he is working with us now. I know we've announced this already, but we're very excited that Aaron has joined the Stuff Media family and is going to be doing some shows with us starting pretty soon, actually. I don't think we're announcing exactly what the shows are yet, but he's got one coming out soon. And then we got another one coming out with him this fall. And then hopefully another one to follow. And we're all super excited because Aaron came into town and I was tasked. I guess that's not even the right word because it was a pure pleasure. But I was asked to kind of hang out with Aaron and his production team here and oversee what they were talking about and doing and took him out to a nice dinner. And he's just a great guy. He's super smart. He's funny. He's engaging. He's all the things that fit with our network. And it was just a match made in heaven. So I know you're going to enjoy the shows that we have coming out with Aaron. And I asked him to be on Movie Crush when he was here naturally, because I can't have someone of his talents in the building without getting him in the old booth. And he was happy to do so. And when he picked his favorite movie, The Village, from M. Night Shyamalan, it all sort of clicked into place. And I was like, of course that's his favorite movie. And he goes deep on this one. Well, I won't spoil it, but let's just say that he has a Village theme party every year at his house. That's how much into this movie he is. So here we go, without any further delays. It's me and Aaron Mankey on The Village. It's funny, I've had like a lot of questions for you throughout the day that I've been holding.
Sticking them in a box?
Yeah, personal questions. I was like, oh, nope, can't ask him that yet. But I was curious about your, I've never heard the lore story.
Like the origin story of lore? The brief summary is that it's a complete mistake, which is sort of like always fun to tell people. Yeah. It's a happy mistake, but it's a mistake.
Yeah.
The longer story is I was working as a graphic designer. I did that for almost a decade.
Okay, because that was my one pressing question, was what you did before.
Yeah, design work. I was mostly branding, like logos, business stationery kind of stuff.
Right.
And I was writing in my spare time. I'd always been a writer. Mm-hmm. So just as a hobby.
Yeah, same
and
here.
In the last few years, I'd been writing what I called supernatural thrillers, you know, the kind of thing that Stephen King might write, a little bit on the spooky side. But when I wrote them, I would always go research great New England folklore that people didn't know about.
Right.
Like Mercy Brown in Exeter, Rhode Island, and digging her body up and cutting her heart out and stuff like that.
And it's such a rich area for that stuff, I feel like.
It so is, yeah.
Yeah.
So I you know, starting a novel, I'd go and I'd research stuff and I'd find a dozen really neat ideas and use one or two in the novel. And I just kind of tuck the rest away in Evernote and say, I'll use it someday.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're self-publishing stories, it's an uphill climb, almost vertical to sell stuff. And I was making about $5 a month.
Wow.
So it wasn't really.
It's a labor of love.
It was. And when business is fine, design-wise, you can justify spending your evenings writing stories that don't sell.
Mm-hmm.
But when the business started to do really poorly in the fall of 2014, I was really looking at everything that I spent my time on critically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, is this the most efficient use of my time?
Right.
And writing just, it was going to get cut. So I thought, you know, the thing that the kids do these days on the internet is like, they have an email list, right? You sign up for my email list, then I can market stuff to you. And I thought, if I could get the people on my list, I could sell more books. So how do I get them on my list? Well, I'll give them something for free.
Right.
And I was going to write up my five favorite New England like myths and legends.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote four of the five. I realized I was going to ask people to read a PDF on their iPhone and it just wasn't going to be a valuable thing.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't give me their address for it. So it sounds super cliche, but I clicked the icon on my desktop and I dragged it to my trash can.
Uh-huh.
And as I'm ready to let go, I realized this isn't how I read. Like, I don't read PDFs on a phone. I listen to audiobooks.
Yeah.
So maybe what would be valuable is to give these email subscribers a zip file with MP3s for these stories.
Yeah.
That was as far as I went with this.
Wow.
And I took the first one and I recorded it and sent it to a buddy. This was after learning that the room I recorded in, which was not like this, mm-hmm. Was horsehair plaster, angular walls, hardwood floor.
Yeah.
I did it in front of a glass monitor with the mic on my desk.
You made all the mistakes.
All the mistakes. And so I put some music underneath it, like an Instagram filter to mm-hmm. kind of make it better.
Yeah.
And I sent it to a friend and I told him my grand scheme and he said, don't do it. And well, that's it.
Wow.
He said, no, this is a podcast. And I kind of fought him on that. I'm like, no, a podcast is...
What year was this?
This was, it was actually 3 years ago this month.
Oh, wow.
It was March of, like it's March of 15. Yeah. It feels like it's, just been part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I took him at his word and in about 48 hours, I branded it, you know, being a logo designer, that was pretty easy for me. Called it Lore, set up a website.
Such a great logo too.
Simple.
Yeah.
You know, it gets it across. And I hit launch.
Wow.
And 3 years later, I'm still doing it, which is, it's pretty fun.
To great success.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. You're being very modest.
Look, if I want to brag, most podcasts, I don't know if you've heard this, most podcasts, like somebody starts a show and they do multiple episodes. Mm-hmm. Over the course of their show, we'll get about 1,000 downloads.
Oh, really?
Like for every episode added together over lifetime.
Wow.
And it was sometime in the fourth month of the show that I was in the hundreds of thousands of downloads and was able to sell ads.
That's crazy.
And by the time those checks came in, I was full time.
So you were able to quit your job.
I was able to quit the dyeing design business and go full time into this. That was June or July of 2015.
Yeah.
A month later, I started getting TV offers. That fall, I started getting publishing offers. Started doing live shows.
Man,
and then it's just been that crazy downhill, like roller coaster ride ever since.
That's nuts because Josh and I, you can definitely trace a through line to being the beneficiaries of getting in super early.
Right.
When two unknown dudes could get away with just putting their voices out on the air and people would take a listen.
Yeah.
The discoverability issue was not around back then. But you're like, that's a true success. I mean, we obviously like we're good at whatever we did. Or
yeah.
We would have gone away.
I mean, I'd like to think
so. But you're a huge success story. Like a few years ago, there was tons of podcasts out there. So for you to get found like that as someone who didn't have a name before
right.
in the podcasting world.
This was...
It's like really great. That shows what a great storyteller you are.
Oh, I appreciate that.
You know?
I always tell people I'm making it up as I go along.
Right.
And evidently some of this stuff is just kind of hardwired into me.
Uh-huh.
So I'm okay with that. But I think Serial came out like its first season in the fall of 14, mm-hmm. I think. So that was really the beginning of that new wave.
And you were after that?
And I was March of 15, so just a few months later. And there were more shows popping up. I think mm-hmm. people had, they caught on months before. Podcasting might be the place to make new content. I hadn't been thinking about that.
Yeah.
I fell in. So I leaned against the door, not knowing it was a door, and I fell in. Mm-hmm. like some sort of a Mr. Bean episode.
Was that you?
That was me.
Okay. I wondered who that was.
I feel like I did get ahead of, I came after the Serial bump.
Right.
But it was certainly before what we've seen over the last year.
Yeah, which is sort of crazy.
When podcasts start left and right announcing TV options mm-hmm. and things like that, which I, very proud to be one of those.
Yeah.
Like you.
In a way, yeah.
In a way, yeah.
we had our brief run.
There's one other comedy show that's been picked up multiple seasons, I think.
Mm-hmm. Comedy Bang Bang?
Comedy Bang Bang, 5 seasons, I think.
Yeah, and Maron had a nice little run. I think
that's
he had
true.
3 or 4 seasons.
Okay. But, going into a second season of a TV show based on a podcast, I feel like I've reached a new level of
that's totally
amazement.
A new level.
Yeah. So I'm pretty happy about that. But nowadays there's just so many shows.
I know.
There's so much out there.
Yeah.
That the good the stuff
challenge.
Too.
Well, and we're trying to grow as a network, so it's always we're having to learn as we go too, as far as like now how do you get attention?
Right.
Everyone's spread thin as listeners. But hopefully the audience is built too, like in lockstep.
Absolutely.
I know it's interesting now that like my family now listens to podcasts. And I think for a while, everyone's like, yeah, Chuck's doing that thing that he has to explain to everybody what it is. But now I'm just hearing from kind of everyone, either listening to mine or other ones. I'm like, okay, it's officially kind of crept into the masses.
Yeah. Yeah. When I first started, my wife wasn't listening to podcasts at all.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't how she did things. She's a book person.
But, yeah, same with Emily. She doesn't, still didn't listen to a ton of podcasts.
Yeah, but there's a number of shows now that she listens to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mine, which is weird.
Really?
When I walk into the house and she's upstairs quilting and I can hear my voice coming out of the room, it's very weird. But
yeah, Emily listens to Movie Crush a little bit now.
Oh, cool.
Never really listened to Stuff You Should Know, which is fine.
Yeah.
Like I always thought, why in the hell would she want to listen to me more?
Right.
But she listens to Movie Crush some now, and she's on Movie Crush some now.
Oh, nice.
Because we did our pre-Oscar special and then our Oscar special.
Oh, cool.
And everyone is like, more Emily. So
see,
we're going to figure out a way to get her in there more.
Someday it'd be like, the cry is less Chuck.
Right. It probably already
That's
is.
That's great.
So you grew up in the greater Boston area?
No, I actually grew up in Illinois.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm a Midwestern boy.
I did not know that.
And then in 99, I moved out to the Boston area. And
so what part of Illinois?
Couple hours. So I grew up in a little town that's about an hour north of Bloomington,
mm-hmm.
In that middle of Illinois range where every city is 30 minutes away from each other
right.
on a nice northwest, east-south grid.
Uh-huh.
A little town called Streeter.
Nice.
Yeah.
Small town guy then.
Small town guy. Yeah. I think there were about 12,000 people in my town.
The siblings?
Two younger brothers.
Tight family?
No. My parents, I was pretty quick to answer that,
yeah.
wasn't I? Yeah. I'm pretty close with my younger brother.
Uh-huh.
But my parents went and had us all 4 years apart,
mm-hmm.
which meant that we were never in the same schools together, essentially.
Right.
You know, once I was out of middle school, and the way that my schools worked is grade school went through fifth, and then you went across town to a sixth, seventh, and eighth place.
Okay.
And then the 4 years of high school were in a different place.
Right.
So every time I moved to a different school building, that's when my other brother would come in.
Right.
And then after him, the last brother would come in.
You just replacement mankies.
Yeah. Yeah. There was always a manky around,
right.
but it just wasn't me. We did that. And that meant that we had our own circle of friends,
mm-hmm.
our own interests.
Right.
4 years apart, you're different fads, different, you know, like my middle brother was really into skateboarding, but I never was. I was more into comic books and my youngest brother's more into hunting. Like it's very, very different.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. How'd your parents feel about having three very different kids?
I think my mom wanted a girl all along and
uh-huh.
kept hoping and hoping. Eventually, we just got a dog.
Yeah.
And my mom made sure it was a
female
girl.
Dog?
A female dog, yeah. So,
As far as movies figuring in, I've kind of run the gamut in here with people that some grew up in New York City with access to everything.
Yeah.
Other people were suburban mall kids. Other people grew up in towns where they had to drive to another town to see a movie.
Yeah.
What was your deal?
So we had a Majestic in town,
which was
glorious. And mm-hmm. I think at this point it's been closed up for good. It's been brought back a couple of times.
Yeah.
We go back periodically and sometimes it's open, sometimes it's not.
Right.
But
it's always there.
If I think about a theater, that's my deep memory is mm-hmm. that movie theater, Majestic.
Single screen?
Two screens, actually,
okay.
I think. Yeah. And I saw a lot of my early movies there. But I think like you, I grew up in a more conservative family.
Mm-hmm.
So I was policed a bit more about what I could and couldn't see.
Right.
And as I got older, I was able to explore and branch out. But
also had the gamut run in here with guests as far as it's always interesting to me to see what was allowed. Because when you grow up like we did in a little more restrictive content household.
Yeah.
I was always super jealous, of course, of kids who could do anything. But I know Roman Mars is a mutual friend, and you listen to his episode.
Oh, yeah.
And he could watch anything whenever at a very young age.
Didn't he say he saw
something
Blue
crazy.
Lagoon at like four?
That's right.
It's crazy.
And someone else, who was it that I interviewed? I think one of their first memories of seeing a movie was like The Shining when they were 8 or 10.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if that was Hodgman. I mean, he was very
Hodgman, but
autonomous as a kid.
Yeah, he very famously like grew up in this giant house full of empty rooms
with his own suite.
Yeah, like just a ghost house.
Yeah, oh, I love John.
Yeah, he's the best. Just saw him in New York last week, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, we put a hurting on a Keen Steakhouse.
Nice. I have yet to hang out with him, but we've connected online.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm sure
good
it'll
guy.
Happen at some
yeah.
point. Well, and he's a Brookline guy, so
he is. Yeah,
you guys can.
Yeah.
Catch up on all things Massachusetts.
He's always at the Bell House doing stuff with
Jean Grey.
Jean Grey.
Uh-huh.
And I've played the Bell House before.
Yeah.
It's a great place.
It is great.
So it's funny to see different families and how they let their kids jump
yeah,
into that.
How strict, like
yeah.
what was it like?
my house was, I had a very fundamental Christian mom.
Uh-huh.
So like on the music side of things, as an illustration, the most mainstream I could get was Weird Al.
Oh, wow.
You know, I could get...
Who you just met.
I did. A couple nights ago, I got to meet Weird Al. It was fantastic. He's doing this tour right now. Have you heard about this?
Mm-mm.
Do you know Weird Al's music much?
Well, when I was a kid, like the popular stuff, but I never like delved in as a fan.
So like you'd buy an album of his and there'd be a bunch of parodies on it, you know, Eat It instead of Beat It, things like that. But there'd also be originals that he wrote.
I did not know that.
Him and his band, they're amazing songwriters.
Oh, really?
And he's, when you're not tied to making sure you match the rhythm of Beat It to write the words, like he can just be a lot more creative. So I think some of his originals are even better than the parodies.
Really?
So his tour right now is all the original material.
Huh.
It's like the non-parody tour.
Wow.
So stuff he's not famous for, he's touring
fan,
on.
Yeah. The deep cuts for the fans.
That's right. And he did 2 sellout shows at the Wilbur on Sunday. He did a matinee and an evening. And I work with the folks at the Wilbur for my live tour stuff. So I managed to get a little inside access. But, you know, that was my connection to popular music.
Uh-huh.
If Weird Al covered Nirvana, I got to listen to the bass line and you know, get that rough version of the guitar.
Interesting.
But not Nirvana.
Right.
And
you couldn't bring that in the house.
Yeah. So that was, I was a little bit more held back. But there were, you know, I'm thinking back to one of my early movie memories when I was 10 or 11. I think it was 86. I must have been 11. My birthday party was me and a bunch of neighborhood friends going to see Annie.
Uh-huh.
That original 80s version of
hey
the
man,
film.
And I love that movie.
It was great.
Yeah.
So that's my earliest movie memory. And that was pretty safe for my mom. Like, she was okay with that.
Annie was all right.
Annie was all right. Yeah.
And I still love that movie. I know there, I mean, it probably always gets thought of as a little girl's thing. But I don't know why. Maybe it was one of those HBO things that I just saw over and over. But I still love that original, that 80s Albert Finney, Carol Burnett, Tim Curry.
Yep.
I can't remember who played Annie, but she was so iconic for me.
I'll have to look into that. I wonder if she's gone on to do other things.
I know the name. Well, I mean, I've even looked her up recently, and she still looks the same and still is, like, you know, very much capitalizing on being Annie.
Well, I mean, at some point.
As she should.
It's one of my earliest memories. Mm-hmm. I don't have my dates right, but I also remember seeing Empire Strikes Back at the drive-in that used to be outside my hometown.
Oh, wow.
I think the only film I ever saw there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was big.
Yeah.
Know, big on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
Space battles and all that. So that was great.
Yeah, I was able to get the original Star Wars in as a 6-year-old.
Mm.
So what about movies is like in the house, and did you do like family movie night? You had the VCR going, or was mom kind of like really hovering over that stuff?
It's weird. My dad was the kingpin of entertainment in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So if he wasn't watching it, we didn't watch it, you know.
Right. He held the control.
Yeah. He held the control all the time. So, you know, if I didn't want to watch Night Court and Cheers at night with him, I'd be upstairs reading. Like, he just, you can't ask him to change the channel. And that's fine. It was his house. He was
two
the king.
Good shows, at least, in that case.
Yeah, yeah. But he had a lot of VCR. He actually had 2 Betamax players as well. But
early adopter?
Yeah, early adopter. But I remember him having a lot of, like, videotaped copies of Burt Reynolds movies.
Mm-hmm.
Cannonball.
Yeah.
9 to 5. I don't think Burt Reynolds was in 9 to 5, but that's gotten a lot of buzz lately because they're remaking 9 to 5.
I just saw that.
Yeah.
Don't know quite how to feel because that original 9 to 5 is so great.
Well, the talk is that the 3 gals will come back and Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda, and is it Lily Tomlin?
Uh-huh.
I think we'll come back and be in it, they've said.
Which would be just other parts?
I don't know. It's interesting.
Wow, that'd be interesting.
But I like it when that happens. Like the new Mary Poppins movie. Do you know Dick Van Dyke is going to be in it?
No, and I saw that the trailer for that just dropped, but I haven't seen it yet.
It's like one of those little teasers that doesn't give you much.
Oh, okay, but I love Emily Blunt, and I think that's inspired casting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And why not? Because it's not a remake. It's
like a Further Adventures of kind of thing.
Yeah, like a weird sequel thing.
Yeah. So it's funny because those aren't the cleanest movies.
Uh-huh.
You know, Cannonball Run is not a...
It would be like a PG-13 today.
Probably.
I think.
Caddyshack. You know, things that fall into this realm are what my dad would have watched. And so I love it.
So mom probably did not approve of that.
Probably not.
But it was okay with Dad.
Yeah. Because Dad was okay with it, I got to watch some of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, man, let's start talking about The Village.
Yeah.
Let me say this, too. When I got in touch with you about doing this, and you're live here in Atlanta, mm-hmm. right, to point out to everybody, you said The Village, and being a lore listener, I immediately just thought, oh, well, of course.
Of course.
It's The Village. What if you would have said 9 to 5, I would have been shocked.
Right.
But it just seemed to fit.
Yeah.
Kind of everything about you. And especially after hanging out today and hearing just kind of what you're into, mm-hmm. this is like the Venn diagram, like, as you said earlier, aligns perfectly in one big circle.
It really is.
And The Village, I think, wasn't there a circle on the cover?
There might have been.
Why do I want to say their movie poster? It was like a circle or something.
I've got it on my iPad right here.
But this is from 2004, from M. Night Shyamalan, starring William Hurt, Sigourney Weaver, great cast, Joaquin Phoenix.
Oh, yeah.
Adrian Brody, Bryce Dallas Howard, Brendan Gleeson, who is always great.
Oh, my gosh, he's so good.
Yeah, a young Judy Greer. And I noticed even a young Jesse Eisenberg.
Yes.
Like in the background almost.
He doesn't have a last name. I think his character is just Jameson.
Right.
But he's in there and he has some dialogue. And
yeah.
And I mean, I know he's younger, but it just looks like Jesse Eisenberg out in the cast.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's great.
It's little Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize until rewatching it last night that he was in it. And this is the 1, 2, 3, 4th output from M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
And I think it helps, like, we're going to frame this in the context of his career as we go, I think.
Yeah.
Because he's a really interesting filmmaker in that he's done some, he started out so strong.
Yeah.
And then I think most people agree at some point made some pretty bad movies.
Yeah.
And I think most people agree he's kind of come back now lately.
So I haven't seen Split. So I can't, okay. I can't comment on the comeback stuff, mm-hmm. but I've heard really good things about it.
It was definitely better than the ones that preceded it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've watched, you know, I think it was, what was the first Bruce Willis movie with him?
Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense. That was kind of set the tone. And it's a hard act to follow.
Sure.
It was so brilliant mm-hmm. with that twist at the end that nobody was expecting. I think the idea of the twist at the end has become a lot more used.
It was very novel at the time.
It was.
Not that a twist had never been in a movie, but to that degree,
right.
It was all the buzz.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah. So when the twist happens and it reframes the entire movie,
mm-hmm.
when you at that point, you almost have to go back and rewatch it.
Right.
You know?
Which is a kind of a great little director's trick.
It is, yeah.
As far as getting people to see your thing twice.
Exactly, you know? Yeah. You should make podcasts because then you get twice the downloads.
Exactly.
Yeah. I remember watching all the way through up until is it the Lady in the Water?
Lady in Water was right after The Village.
Yeah.
And I think by most people's accounts, that's kind of when the slide started.
But I liked that movie.
I didn't see it.
Lady in the Water. It has a lot to do with, like, belief and mm-hmm. folklore and
right.
how we keep things alive through our belief in them. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, you got American Gods echoing that theme as well these days from Neil Gaiman in the TV show, that the gods draw their powers from
right.
those who believe in them, and the new gods of media uh-huh. have supplanted the old gods of the old world. And
I haven't seen that yet. Good?
I haven't seen the show.
Oh, okay.
Although anything Gillian Anderson makes is mm-hmm. brilliant.
Yeah.
The novel is amazing.
Yeah.
If you're not a paper book person, mm-hmm. the multicast audiobook of that is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, you're into the audiobooks, huh?
I am, yeah. But I'm an audio guy. Well, but you are too.
Right. I think I've only listened to one audiobook in my life on a road trip years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Huh.
I should, because it's a great, because I went through a couple of years where I read a ton, like literally read like 25 or between 25 and 30 books in a year.
Wow.
And then didn't read for 8 years.
Yeah.
Like at all.
Wow.
So I need to kind of find a nice balance where I read 5 or 6 books a year.
Yeah. I'm in a drought right now.
Mm-hmm.
You can't read while you're writing, and I write all the time these days. It's really, and my brain's tired after reading research and all that. So I might throw on a fiction, you know, just some sort of a novel that uh-huh. it's more like candy. Like right now I'm listening to Artemis by Andy Weir.
Right. Is it good?
And it's great. Yeah, it's good. Rosario Dawson does the narration. Oh, she just nice. Some great accents and, mm-hmm. and it's just a one person audiobook, but it's good. But for the most part, I'm kind of dry right now.
Right. All right. So Sixth Sense, good movie. Unbreakable.
Oh,
really, really
so
love
good.
That movie.
Unbreakable is so great.
Yeah. And I think, for fans of his, that's sort of like one of the tops, mm-hmm. if not the top.
Yeah.
And they're continuing that story too.
Yeah. Like, again, I haven't seen Split, but I've heard it's a continuation in some sense. Like,
well, extending, I don't want to ruin it.
Right. I think
sure.
the world gets extended in some way.
Yeah.
And then he's wrapped up editing on Glass, which if you've seen right. Unbreakable, that the name resonates well with Mr. Glass.
Yeah.
So, I'm excited to see what he does with it.
Okay, so he's shot that then.
I think he shot it and edited it, but they're holding on to it for a few months.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm excited about that. Yeah. Signs bugged me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just in the asking a bit too much in the suspension of belief department? Or?
No, I think I haven't seen it since then. So if I remember correctly, I ended up being a little bugged by all of the way it wrapped up so neatly with all the little things coming together, like the little girl's water glasses that she wouldn't finish, playing into the way it resolved its story.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like everything was a little too cutely packaged resolution-wise.
You like some loose ends?
Not even that. I might have been starting my burnout on M. Night Shyamalan at that point.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Did you love it?
It's not a favorite of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was a bad movie. But then again, I jump on and look at The Village reviews online, even if, you know, they're, 14 years old?
Yeah.
Evidently not a lot of people like that one either.
Well, who cares about that?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into The Village then. do you remember your first experience with it?
I don't, actually. And there's a reason for that, mm-hmm. because I think I enjoyed it so much that we've incorporated it into family tradition. To me, The Village is an autumn movie.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like the fall.
For sure.
The coloring,
yeah.
the setting. So every autumn, we have a village viewing party.
Really?
And we invite friends over. Uh-huh. It's kind of potluck. Everybody brings a dish, dessert, and whatever. And we got like sticks with red berries on them, uh-huh. and decorate the table. And it's great. And then we all get quiet and we play the movie.
Uh-huh.
And then afterwards, consistently for a decade, we've done this for 10 years now.
Wow.
There's about a good hour and a half of conversation afterwards about the movie.
Really?
Just always a new layer that unfolds where we see things
same
we
people?
Didn't before. There are some who have been there for most of them,
uh-huh.
but then there's always, you know, that new couple that you meet or
right.
A friend of a friend who has heard the movie is good but has never seen it. It becomes this place where people come to see it for the first time among
yeah.
people who love it. And like the conversation is bolstered by having fresh takes.
Right.
And then right across the room, you've got people who have seen it 10 uh-huh. times and they've also seen a new thing, but they're all different. And
wow.
Yeah, it's really cool.
How do I get on that list?
Man, we'll put you on. You got to come to Boston, though.
Wish I lived closer. What do you call that? Does it have a name?
Just The Village Party.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yep. Not The Village People.
Nothing fancy. Not The Village People. No. Nobody's dressed up as a cop.
That'd be confusing. So, like I said, great cast.
Yeah.
I mean, William Hurt, like, I could – you don't get enough of that guy anymore.
No.
You know? Yeah, I mean, he's just, I feel like growing up, he was in a lot more stuff, and I just wish he was still all over the place.
Yeah, and him in The Village, like that role, mm-hmm. and especially the last third of the movie, where he just comes alive as this passionate, torn man.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know that I've ever seen him that powerful in a role before.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the movie later on, and I don't know how you want to go into this, but
all of these are going to, this whole movie is going to be, or this whole episode is going to have spoilers. So
yeah.
I think most people know that, but just check out now if you don't want the
yeah.
movie spoiled.
But there's the scene at the end where he is imploring the other elders. He's presented his plan.
Mm-hmm.
Ivy's going to go off and do this.
And, yeah.
And they're, you know, they're pissed. And he just, there's his speech where he's just preaching to them about why this is the, it might not be a good idea, but it's the only idea and it's right. the best idea. And that there's a difference there. And either right before or right after, he's also having the same conversation with his wife, and they're kind of, they're not having the same conversation as each other. Mm-hmm. He's trying to defend his choice, and she's trying to get a message across without actually saying the words.
Right.
And he's so good. It's such a masterful performance.
Yeah, and I think because this movie, like, I tried to watch it through fresh eyes last night.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd seen it since back in the day, and I don't think I saw it in the theater then. So I tried to just, like, you know, tabula rasa my mm-hmm. brain and go in with fresh eyes. And I think I liked it more
oh, good.
Last night
yeah.
than before, for sure.
Yeah.
In fact, I know I did. Because I started paying attention more just to sort of the craft of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think before the whole twist thing, it was starting to bug me from M. Night. So I went into it looking for this twist
mm-hmm.
and thinking this is what this guy does. And so I think I figured it out early on
mm-hmm.
and that bothered me.
Had you forgotten the twist?
Last night?
Like before, when you sat down last night to watch it.
Oh, I knew.
You remembered it.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. So I was able to sort of put that annoyance aside.
Right.
And go into it and just say, hey, let me look at the craft of this movie. And I started noticing, like, the cinematography and the great mm-hmm. use of color.
Oh, yeah.
The color palette in this movie.
Yep.
And it's just so atmospheric and moody. And he really, really set a tone that I appreciated last night, whereas I didn't before, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's the tools that we're used to seeing filmmakers use to get across a mood or,
mm-hmm.
Or a conflict. And it's usually dialogue and music.
Yeah.
And I think he dips into deeper dimensions mm-hmm. in this film where colors that you might, you know, they set up early that red is the bad color.
Right.
You see the two young ladies, you know, just goofing off while they're cleaning, and they notice a red flower and they pull it up and they bury it in the yard. And then they're kind of so disturbed, they just go back to cleaning with no play.
Uh-huh.
And that's almost immediately sets that tone for red being the bad color. And
right.
then that way later on, he doesn't even have to point out the red, or you don't even have to have the bad, you know, the creature, the bad guy or whatever dressed mm-hmm. in red. You can just have the protagonist standing in a forest and red is around her.
Yeah. That shot was so great.
That dread kind of mm-hmm. as a viewer creeps over you. Nobody has to tell you.
Yeah.
The color does it for you.
So. Yeah, it's like he sort of sets these rules
mm-hmm.
For the colors. Like the good color was the sort of goldish yellow.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's obvious allusions to like Little Red Riding Hood going on
right.
as the story progresses, one of the great, great stories. But he sets these rules up, A, with the kind of the colors, and B, with the rules of the what was the place called that they lived? Not Connecticut Woods.
Covington Woods.
Covington Woods.
Yeah.
You know, that they have this arrangement where there are these creatures, these monsters that live in the woods. We live in this clearing. They don't bother us. We don't bother them, essentially.
Yeah.
Don't go in the woods. Everything will be fine.
Yep.
So he establishes those ground rules, and then it's fun to see that sort of get undone and the tension build
right.
as it plays.
I feel that one of the biggest themes through this movie is the idea of community
mm-hmm.
and maintaining the balance of community versus going rogue, going on your own and setting your own path.
Right.
And the community of Covington in this movie is built around this idea that everyone is a team player
mm-hmm.
who works together, and we do what's always been done because that's what's always been done.
Right.
And this is tradition. So respecting those we don't speak of and
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. And so one of the viewing parties that we had a couple, they were there only for 1 year, but it's a husband and wife and Catherine, she had a master's degree in piano.
Oh, wow.
High level music education
uh-huh.
with an understanding of an ear. And an understanding for what's going on in a film that most people don't pay attention to. But the person who scored the film, you knew was paying attention to that stuff.
Yeah.
And at the end of the film, she said, you know, throughout most of the movie, and I don't remember the term she used, which is going to ruin part of this, but she said a lot of the music that was used was, it was just melody. It was everybody kind of playing along. But whenever Ivy was on screen or Lucius was on screen, and to some extent when Noah Percy, Adrian Brody's character, was brilliant, when they're on screen, the music becomes more independent and solo oriented. It goes off script, essentially. And with the music, she said, it's like they were trying to tell you that there's people playing along as a community.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are bucking the system.
Right.
And we learn through the movie that that's both good and bad.
Yeah.
You know, bucking the system worked great for, you know, Ivy leaving the town and going to get the medicines and all that kind of thing. But at the same time, bucking the system led to Adrian Brody's character kind of screwing everything up.
Right. Which, yeah, we'll get to that in a little more detail.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting, too, that with this viewing party, to get perspectives like that from these people who have various, whatever, professional backgrounds or interests.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
It's been neat. I mean, we've got a number of social workers who are friends of ours, and so they come into that with that lens. Having a musician in the room has been great. I'm a professional storyteller, so I'm always looking for other things and different than other people in the room are. It's like running a really long-term, very tightly focused focus group.
Yeah.
You know, every year we get maybe four or five new responses to the movie.
That's so awesome.
But it presents the movie in a very new way every time. I see something else. Uh-huh. Somebody says, did you notice this? And I'll say, no, I've seen it 10 or 11 or 12 times, but no, I've not seen that part. Yeah. Or noticed that detail in it.
Do you know who would love this? M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
The fact that you're doing this, do you know him? Have you been? Does he know about this?
I don't think.
Have you tweeted never met at him or anything?
I invited him over Twitter once. I don't know him. He doesn't know me. So well, I was just some. I was some rando on Twitter.
Maybe this will get out there.
Yeah.
I mean, you're in the business now.
Yeah.
You're in the TV biz.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think everyone's seen the movie by now. But this community of people in the woods, the monster dwells. Things start falling apart when Lucius. Joaquin Phoenix, who's great in everything ever. There's that truly creepy stabbing scene where who's Adrian Brody's character?
Noah Percy.
Yeah, where Noah stabs Lucius, but it's done in such a it's done in a way that I'd never seen a stabbing done on screen.
Yeah,
which is say off camera, very quiet, and you just see this sort of Joaquin Phoenix turns around and then makes a sort of face and looks down and there's a knife in his belly.
Yeah.
Which
you don't hear anything.
No, it's so unsettling the way he did that.
Yeah. I've never sat down and processed why Shyamalan would present the stabbing in that way, but I feel like it's like on the back of my brain, I can feel the symbolism on it. I just haven't nailed it down yet. There's just something about that you never see the knife go in. You don't even hear a response from Lucius that he's been stabbed.
Yeah.
You see his face and it kind of twists. And then he looks down and then that's when the camera does a shot down and
it's really unsettling.
It is. It is. Because there was no warning.
Yeah. Well, I've got some questions too, since you're clearly the man to go to. Why did he stab him? I didn't quite get that. So he's mentally challenged. Was it because he loved Ivy?
I think it was.
Okay.
It came directly after the announcement that Ivy and Lucius were to be married.
Right. I thought that was it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of scenes of Ivy, who is blind, but also the daughter of kind of the leader of the community.
Yeah.
So she's, in some ways, she is more empowered than anyone else in the village. In other ways, she's less empowered because of her, you know, lack of sight. She makes claims of being able to see the colors in certain people, some sort of a sixth sense that she might have.
Yeah. See what you did?
See that? Yeah. But when you see her interacting with the community the most, she's actually just playing with Noah Percy, who's, you know, because of his disabilities, he's like a large child.
Yeah.
And we see them playing hide and seek
and
tag and things like that. And she acts like a mother in some ways, but in other ways, she's just a really good friend. I think right after hearing that they've been, you know, they've planned to get married.
Yeah.
I don't think there was actually an engagement. I keep wanting to use that word.
But, yeah.
You know, they just announced their intentions to get married.
Uh-huh.
That's when he stabs Lucius.
Yeah, it felt to me like just a very innocent, like he doesn't know why he did it.
Right.
But just like, I want to stop this thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to do it other than to put this sharp thing in and make him go away.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and there's what we learn later on is that when the creatures step out of the woods, creature singular, I guess, steps out of the woods and into the village, then it's actually Noah. He's found a costume,
mm-hmm.
one of the outfits, and he is kind of creeping in and acting out the stories that he's heard all his life.
Right.
Right. And I want to go back and watch it again with this notion of, does he do it in response to interactions between Ivy and Lucius?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the scene on the porch at night.
Yeah.
Where they finally, you know, express their love for each other. And it's a beautiful scene because it's shot from behind and there's a lot of long, quiet shots.
Mm-hmm.
I have to turn the volume really high up to hear that scene because they talk so low
yeah.
and quietly. It's a very, it's a scene with space.
Yeah.
Visually, audibly, there's a lot of space. And I want to say it's directly after that moment that it's like the next day or the next night or something that Adrian Brody's character puts that costume on and
mm-hmm.
does that big thing, like where he goes door to door and then walks. She's waiting in the doorway for Lucius to come help her. And
yeah.
at the very last moment, he slips in
uh-huh.
and then you see the creature's hand. And
yeah.
yeah. I love that scene.
Yeah, that's a great scene. One of the other just creepy shots. I mean, I will say this about M. Night is he can compose a shot that just for mm-hmm. some reason makes the hair on your neck stand up.
Yeah.
And one of the ones was when the three of the teenager boys or whatever were one of them was standing on the stump.
Yeah.
By the edge of the woods
playing the game
by firelight with his arms outstretched. And there's something about the I got chills right now. There's something about the composition of that shot lit by the torches.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the distance of the camera away. I mean, it's literally the composition of that shot is creepy.
It is.
Because the camera's kind of far back and you're just waiting for something to just very quickly snatch that guy off the log.
Right.
Which doesn't happen. But it's all about that buildup of the anticipation of that.
Yeah. There's nothing that happens quickly in that movie.
No.
But you're constantly thinking that something will, because our modern horror brains are wired for it.
Absolutely.
The monster's going to grab and run really quickly, and it mm-hmm. never happens. There's the scene when one of the young men is up in the watchtower.
Yeah.
And so many of the scenes are shot at night at the edge of the forest with mm-hmm. those torches burning, and there's a lot of darkness. Of course, it's as it's intended to be, like a 19th century village. And so
yeah.
there's no electricity and everything's mm-hmm. just dead black. And he hears the thump at the base of either at the base of the watchtower or as if somebody had come up and thumped on the door. And he's frightened out of his wits for a second. And mm-hmm. then finally he peels that trap door up to look down at the ground. And instead of something like lurching up into the opening mm-hmm. or showing its face.
Like the expected thing.
Right. You yeah. just see the creature at a medium pace just pass through the opening down below. Like it's walking along the ground and you just see it pass by.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as frightening as it gets.
Yeah.
But it happens. It's so shocking.
Yeah.
And then he has to step back and process that for a moment before he can even do what he's supposed to do, which is ring the bell.
Right.
And alert the village.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. I mean, you could tell that he was definitely, it was almost like, hey, let me try and experiment and like twists and turns aside.
Yeah.
Let me try and experiment with color and mm-hmm. sound and
yeah.
and pacing that you don't see a lot of. So I have a lot of respect for him doing that.
Yeah.
Very cool. So after the stabbing, that kind of sets what ultimately will resolve the movie in motion, that whole third act.
Mm-hmm.
And William Hurt, as the father of Ivy, lets her in on what, as an M. Night fan, you think, oh, here's the twist.
Right.
There is no creature. They have made this story up to keep people from leaving the community, and there is no creature. So as a first-time viewer who knows, oh, there's probably some twist coming, you think, all right, well, that's probably it.
Now we've got to the twist, yeah.
It was a kind of a clever little bait and switch, actually.
It is. I never thought of it that way, though. I never thought of that as the twist.
Yeah.
But you're right. It is the twist you think you get.
It is a twist.
It is a twist. But it's not
the
twist.
No,
it's
not the
capital, capital T twist.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good way to say it. But that starts her in motion to, in a very Red Riding Hood way, to set off into the woods.
Yeah.
I was about to say by herself, but originally she has two dudes with her.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
drop out of fear. Right?
Right. One of them, right at the start, won't even walk in the woods with her.
Right.
The other one, it's interesting because William Hurt's character not only reveals to her, look, we've invented those we don't speak of.
Mm-hmm.
And has her as a blind woman touch the costume.
Right.
And
which, by the way, the costume is truly great.
I want to get back to that. So,
yeah.
So earmark that.
Okay.
The monster in general, but also the costume. So she's in on it, but nobody else is in on it.
Right.
Right. Except the elders. The mm-hmm. elders know, the handful of adults who started the community. So now she's going to go into the woods and walk, following his instructions, to go find the villages or the towns, as they call the towns.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people coming along who are not in on it. And so they've had to invent new folklore to give the others confidence. So she has this bag of rocks.
Right.
And it's the most clumsy folklore.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's clumsy intentionally, like Shyamalan thought, what's a very not believable bit of folklore to throw at these people? Because
yeah.
we need them to not believe it. Or if it's just unintentionally, it's just stupid.
Mm.
But it's a bag of rocks that are supposed to be magic that keep those we don't speak of away.
Yeah.
Well, why didn't we know about these rocks before? Why weren't we using them as a weapon before? Can't we, whatever. And so one of them won't even come in, just doesn't think it's right. But the other one comes in and I think they like sit in the rain overnight and it's mm-hmm. freezing. And he questions the rocks.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, why? I've never heard of this before. And the moment he leaves and abandons her, she just kind of dumps that bag out.
Yeah.
You know, and it's almost like all the hope was false, but all the hope is gone now.
Yeah. Right?
She's on her own. There's no companionship. There's no help. We could just have a blind woman in the woods in the winter.
It's making her way to an uncertain place.
It's a place she's never been before.
Right. It's not mapped out in her mind.
Right.
Like she knows most of the village
yeah.
as a blind woman, you know, the number of steps and all that stuff.
That's right.
Real quick though, with the first guy that drops out sort of had that another shot that was composed, the way he shot that scene where he won't even enter the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sort of in the distance and they're talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
That was a creepy shot that I felt very much felt like the way it was just set up, like someone's going to run and grab him.
Yeah.
Any second now. And then, of course, it never happened.
Shyamalan does a lot with that border between the edge of the woods and
uh-huh.
the open field
through
the movie, where you really do feel that you're standing on the border between safety and danger.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that scene earlier on in the movie where Lucius is kind of testing the boundaries because he's one of those independent rogue
characters. Yeah, he walks in a bit.
And he walks in a bit. And I love how that's shot where he hears sounds, like we can see his face and he hears cracking in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly either an elder is patrolling the area in the costume or Adrian Brody's character's out there in
right.
the costume. And you only get enough to know that he is stepping back out of the woods at the right time, because if he had stayed in there, he would have encountered the creature.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if we see something pass behind a tree. Like you catch a glimpse of red.
I think so.
And he just kind of, there's no nonsense on his face. He just turns around and just as slowly as he came in, he walks back out.
Yeah, he doesn't haul ass out of there.
No, he doesn't run.
Yeah.
He walks back out very calmly.
Uh-huh.
But there are a lot of shots where you're looking on that tree line.
Yeah.
Right. Where the forest is on your left and the mist filled field is on your right. It's
uh-huh.
just, it's creepy. It's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah. Should we talk about the monster in the costume?
I want to. Yeah.
All right. Let's do it.
Those we don't speak of.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love is that they create this folklore, and this is what it is. I mean, it's folklore. It's new.
Yeah.
But it's stories told to teach, to warn, to guard people from certain things.
Mm-hmm.
They've gone as far as to base it on drawings that they found on rocks on the outskirts of the community.
Yeah.
Because the drawings were there before them. I think he goes on later when he's explaining this to Ivy that they had found the drawings
mm-hmm.
and they used them to kind of fuel this,
yeah.
this folklore. So Shyamalan films all of his movies in Philadelphia.
Right.
Outskirts, in town, mm-hmm. whatever. Like he's a Pennsylvania guy. which I find creatively very intriguing because it creates limits.
Yeah.
You can only do so much in one place.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where he loves to do it. Pennsylvania falls into the realm of Native American tribes called the Algonquin.
Mm-hmm.
And the Algonquin nation has like every culture, they have a lot of folklore.
Yeah.
And one of the creatures in their folklore, this is what I do for a living, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is this little creature called the Pukwudgie.
Uh-huh.
And a Pukwudgie is supposed to be half the size of a human, kind of humanoid in shape, but pig-like in the face,
yeah,
and often has porcupine quills on it. That's how it's often described in Native American folklore. And this would have been, you know, Pukwudgie territory in a sense, right? And
uh-huh.
So to find a creature drawn on a rock, I just wonder, like, someday I want to be able to pin Shyamalan down and say, here's the story of the Pukwudgie. Did this influence
like
the creation?
That, right?
I mean, we're talking about a hog-like face with tusks, quills on the back that come through the red
cape.
It's
gotta be,
right? I mean, it totally feels like it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, if you're going to put a grown human inside of a costume, it has to be human-sized and not half-sized. So that's always been my working theory. I've never read it anywhere. I've never had it confirmed, but.
Oh, I bet you're right.
But I love the outfit, like that whole costume. And I've never seen a cosplay version of it. I've never seen anybody create their own.
Don't think I have either.
Costume. And I would love to see that.
Yeah.
Somebody out there's got
to
do it.
I've never seen it at Halloween.
Yeah.
I've been to a couple of Comic Cons and
Dragon
Con here.
That's a creepy costume.
Yeah.
I would love that.
Oh, hell yeah.
So
why haven't you made one?
I'm not good at that. Someday I'm going to meet Adam Savage and I'm just going to be like, all right, look, this is your white whale. You don't know it.
Uh-huh.
This is the one you're looking for. Make this costume.
Yeah. I've met him a couple of times.
All right. Connect me.
I've been to that his lair.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Oh, dude, it's amazing. And kind of surprised that he doesn't have one of those hanging out in the corner.
It looks like the costume that requires the skills of somebody who has done this many, many times.
Yeah.
He's the candidate for that. But that's
you
my...
You don't want to do a shitty version.
No, it'd be like me in you know, brown sweatpants with a red cape, you know?
So you on a Sunday morning?
And yeah, exactly. Oh, okay. Yeah. And a pig-shaped mask. That's my theory on that, is that there's actually some local folklore, real life, playing into the creation of that creature. And
I bet that's no accident.
Yeah, it can't be.
I bet you're going to get your answer one day, too.
I hope so.
That's what I see. Ivy makes her way to the wall that she is told by her father. You know, he gives her directions basically on how to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
She finds her way to the wall, makes her way over, and
climbs over the ivy. You notice that?
That's true.
Yeah.
And actually, I kind of forgot. As this is going on, he's sort of intercutting the big reveal,
right?
Which is that it is modern times. They have formed this community because each of the elders or the adults there had suffered some sort of violent trauma in their life and met at a group counseling session.
Right.
And William Hurt, through voiceover, we learn, has hatched this idea to remove themselves from the threats of the modern world.
Right.
Which is kind of a great twist.
It is.
It bugged me at the time. I don't know why. Maybe it was my age or the mood I was in that day. But last night, I was like, you know what? This is pretty great as a reveal.
Absolutely. It's a community of people who are so hurt by the world around them that they choose to withdraw from that world and create their own fantasy.
Yeah. And live in that.
And live in that family in generational levels.
Yeah, but not only live in that fantasy. I think what struck me last night was not only, of course, they have to keep it up when they're around everyone else. But when they're in the room just together, they don't go, okay, so what the fuck are we going to do here?
Right.
Things are getting weird.
Right.
They stay in the
they're in character.
The parlance at the time.
24/7.
So that's a lot.
It is.
You know?
I think it speaks to the amount of pain they went through.
Yeah.
You know, that's the impetus for running away.
To this giant cosplay game. Because they didn't have to go back in time necessarily, although that really makes it foolproof as far as no communication with the outside world.
Yeah, I get the impression from the photo they show in that cutscene that it was maybe mid to late 70s.
Yeah, that's kind of what it looked
when
like.
They met up and they hatched this plan. So you're talking about a world that was pre-internet, you know, pre-personal computer, but we have electricity, we have automobiles, you know. So it made sense. I think they went back to the 1890s. The opening scene is a funeral.
Yeah.
For the son of Brennan Gleeson's character.
Right.
And the tombstone, I think it says something like 1896
it does.
Yep. Or whatever.
Uh-huh. It's just kind of off screen.
Yeah. I mean, so they're visually lying to you right away.
Yeah.
Right. That it's not that they hinted at it with costume and tradition. No, they put a date right there on the tombstone. So
yeah. Like the only thing he didn't do was put the Chiron on the bottom of the screen that says like, here's the year.
Right. 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 Yeah. Maybe that was what, you know, a bridge too far. I don't know.
Probably so.
Yeah.
He got it in there though.
He did.
So they reveal this kind of great reveal, and then intercutting it. I think it was pretty smart the way he did it, intercutting it with Ivy getting over the wall, the Ivy wall, and hearing a car siren from this park ranger.
Right.
Which immediately, like, she knows the one reveal, which is there are no creatures, but she still doesn't know that it's modern times.
Yeah, and well, and right? What we've missed between her leaving the village to walk into the woods and reaching the ivy-covered fence is that she encounters the creature.
Oh, well, of course.
That Noah Percy he's been imprisoned in his, like, quiet room at his parents' house, but that's the room where, in a trap door beneath the floor, they keep the costume, which he has found. He's then escaped the house, and he's off in the woods following after her. Essentially.
Yeah. So that was my question for you is he trying to kill her just keep her from leaving?
I think he's trying to keep her from leaving. I think he's playing. When he puts that costume on, he really believes he's the creature.
And okay.
I think he's playing with her. But to her, she's being chased. She's blind. She can't see anything. So she can't see. It's clearly a human in a costume.
Right.
Right. But she hears very odd noises. She's being chased. And at some point is able to kill the creature. Mm-hmm. Although I don't think she knows she's killed it.
I don't think so either.
But she knows that there's a hole in the ground and uses that mental map in her head to lead it back to that hole where it falls in. And she has, they touch on this at the very end. She fought the creature and won.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though she's been told by her father that there are no creatures, everybody's going to believe now that while Ivy was out doing this amazing task, she encountered the creature and
she made it real.
And she made it real.
Uh-huh.
She lived it out completely.
Yeah.
So by the time she reaches that ivy covered fence that separates the reserve from the road, you don't know where she's at mentally, right? Because she, you know, her world's been upended.
Yeah. What did you think? Do you think that because she was being stalked by a creature that she was just told didn't exist?
Yeah.
I sort of thought, as someone who hasn't seen it, you know, 15 times, that maybe she thinks the creature is real and that her father may have been lying to her to get her just to go do this thing.
Yeah. I've never thought of it that way, but that's actually, because they don't express that, but I can see her believing that maybe he gave me the false confidence that it was safe to go through the woods.
But she's lived her whole life believing in this thing.
Right.
And is just told that it's not real, but
and
then is clearly being stalked by this thing.
Right. Yeah.
Kind of a, kind of mind sex?
Yes.
I don't want to say
mind,
the bad word. Although I do curse on here. I don't know why that felt weird to say that. It was very strange. Mind sex. That's my new band name.
Mind sex.
So she gets over the wall. She is found by the park ranger guy. This is kind of one of my only big beefs with the movie is I thought that casting of that guy, I thought he was not too great. And then the gratuitous insertion of M. Night into his own movies always has bugged me.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's the same with Tarantino for me.
Yeah.
I never minded Hitchcock, but I don't know. It always takes me out of the movie. I think that's what bugs me about it.
Because that's the point every time I watch it that I'm looking back at the people around me and I say, that's the guy that wrote and directed the movie. You know?
If you don't know that, then it's probably fine.
Yeah.
But he's not a good actor, and same with Tarantino. It always just immediately sucks me out of the movie.
I can see that.
But that's just my personal
opinion. Yeah. I respect that desire to be in the story to some degree. It's a bit part. I can see from the casting perspective, you know, do we want to pay somebody,
right,
you know, to do, what was it, like 2 minutes on screen?
Yeah.
Hold a newspaper and give a couple warnings to the junior park ranger.
Yeah, and you never see his face except in the reflection of the medicine cabinet.
Yeah, yeah. And you're always wondering, is he going to look up and notice what the guy's doing? And he doesn't.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah,
but
that was
right.
a stretch. Yeah. But I
this guy's like 4 feet away stealing like vials of injectables.
Yeah. He was a very awkward, that character, the junior park ranger, was very awkward. I feel like so awkward that I wouldn't have been able to keep the newspaper up and just talk through it. I would have had to put it down and be like, dude, why are you high? What are you doing?
So another question here then. He said something about, I think the exposition gets a little clumsy there, but it was the wrap up. So I'll forgive him for that.
Yeah.
But he says something about it being a no-fly zone that some rich guy had paid. Like that's the part I never quite understood.
William Hurt's character, his story, his tragedy of getting in was that his father was killed by a business associate.
Okay.
His father was a billionaire.
Oh, because the reserve is named after him, right?
Right.
Gotcha.
So Walker, the Walker Reserve. Yeah. So William Walker? Edward Walker. Yeah. Edward Walker's father, William Hurt, Edward Walker, whatever. Yeah. I would assume then he inherits his father's billions.
Okay, that makes sense.
And uses that money to set up the trust, set up the reserve, and then whatever other political mechanisms need to go into place, like no-fly zones.
Right.
To preserve that place.
Okay, I think I missed the money part.
Yeah.
Because then it all makes sense.
Yeah.
Money, you can do whatever
you want. You can do whatever, yeah. that's a world they wouldn't have been able to live for much longer.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point, satellite photography jumps into our world.
Yep.
Google Maps. And how do you manage that? Keeping people from, you know, satellites go around the earth.
Yeah.
Constantly updating their photos.
It's got to be like Wakanda. Have you seen Black Panther yet?
I haven't seen it yet. Do they cover that to some degree?
Well, you know, the idea is that there's a false jungle canopy.
Oh, okay. That keeps the cameras from seeing things.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they wouldn't have been able to do that.
No.
Because they were like out in the middle of an open field.
Right.
So I think at some point the jig was up.
Yeah, the jig was definitely up. But she gets the medicine. She goes back. She's able to save. And, well, there's also that powerful moment when she's gone and Adrian Brody's – or Noah has been killed.
Yeah.
And the parents, is a very sad scene. I can't remember the actress's name. She's great, though. She's been in a bunch of stuff over the years.
Which one?
That plays Noah's mother, Brendan Gleeson's wife.
Oh.
She's terrific. She's
yeah.
She's been all over the place over the years. But where they basically are like, is this the end of it here?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do we want to do? And it's a pretty powerful scene where they all cast their vote by standing with Walker or with William Hurt.
Yeah. And Sigourney Weaver's character is the first to stand up.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And basically like, no, you know, we're gonna keep doing it.
Right. And at this point, they've sacrificed human life.
Yeah.
To maintain the facade.
Right.
So it's even more important to keep going.
Yeah. And she gets back with the medicine.
Right. Saves. And then we never know what happens. Well, we don't know.
Well, that's true. Fair point. I thought, well, of course he's saved, but yeah, it ends on a bit of an ambiguous note. What was her sort of last thing?
It's I think she just says, I've returned.
Mm-hmm.
And then it cuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your complaint against Signs, I think, was too many things buttoned up.
Yeah.
They certainly didn't button up enough things or button up everything with the village.
For sure.
And I like that. I like that there's that open-ended, what happened?
Uh-huh. You know?
Does the marriage and future of Ivy and Lucius, do they become the new elders? Do they maintain the farce?
Right.
Do they patrol in the costume
and
keep the secret?
Yeah, because you do get a sense of, like, how long can this go on?
Right.
There's got to be an end point at some point.
Yeah.
But they've managed to raise one generation through there. I mean, some of these, they look like late teens, early 20s at least.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Lucius is a baby in the photo from them in the
70s. Uh-huh.
He looks like who knows how old he's supposed to be in the story.
But you get the feeling like 17 to 20 years have passed.
Yeah.
Probably.
I think so. A couple of decades. I have questions about, like, the practical nature of their community.
Uh-huh.
Where did they get the stone? Like, there's a lot of stonework in these houses.
Yeah, beautiful.
Beautiful stone. Uh-huh. You know, so did they hire somebody who is skilled in, you know, mid to late 19th century right. stonemasonry.
And then forget about this place,
or knock them off, right. you know, and dump them in the woods. Like, how did they handle this?
Yeah, I think this is one of those movies where you definitely, like, you don't need to look too closely.
Right.
Because the cracks might show a little bit.
Yeah.
But sure, yeah, there's some stuff like that.
Right.
But who cares, right?
It's a movie.
Yeah. Well, great, man. That was awesome. So we finish here with a couple of segments. Actually, I usually do trivia. The only bit of trivia I have in here was that Ashton Kutcher was originally cast as Noah.
Really?
But dropped out due to scheduling.
Wow.
And I think we can all be thankful for that.
We can be very thankful.
there were some other actors that they named that may have, but I think he was actually going to shoot the movie, which would have been pretty bad.
So leading up to the promotion, well, I guess part of the promotion, leading up to the premiere of this movie,
mm-hmm.
the Sci-Fi Channel ran this like 2-hour special on M. Night Shyamalan that—
Oh, really?
It involved a documentary team that was getting access to go to the site, which uh-huh. now looking back, I know it was like the Open Village community area, you know, where all the houses were around.
Yeah.
They were going to go there to interview him, and they did, and he was very cranky and elusive, and they are also interviewing people in Philly who were like fans of Shyamalan, who mm-hmm. watched him come and go from his house, and these kids were also doing Ouija board stuff at home. It was a really bizarre, kind of spooky mockumentary
uh-huh.
about Shyamalan to lead up to the launch of this movie.
Right.
And I liked it. It was on the Sci-Fi yeah. Channel. It was kind of like there was some story about him almost drowning in a lake as a kid. And maybe he's touched in some way after that experience.
Huh.
And these kids messing with otherworldly forces with the Ouija board. And then of course the film crew coming back to their hotel room to find that all of the research that they've done for this documentary has
right.
been stolen or destroyed.
And, yeah, yeah.
It was well done.
And you saw that back then before this?
I think I saw it before The Village. In fact, I don't remember when I first saw The Village, but I can remember watching this special.
Right.
So setting it up for me.
So were you a fan of his back then, as in like, oh boy, man, his next joint is coming out. Can't wait to go see The Village.
Not in the sense that, like a lot of people we know who would say, oh, a new Star Wars movie, mm-hmm. and watching teasers and then trailers and
right.
counting down the days. I wasn't religiously tracking the next movie.
Okay.
But it was on my radar that he had something new coming. Gotcha. Again, this was 2004.
Yeah.
Being on social media wasn't really a thing then.
Right.
This is pre-Twitter.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. So this part you're not going to like, but I always go back and see what Ebert said about all these movies.
Mm.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
This is on one of his most hated movies list.
Really?
He hated it.
Oh.
He gave it 1 star, and he had this to say. I'm sorry you have to hear this.
Oh, man.
I feel so bad. The Village is a colossal miscalculation, a movie based on a premise that cannot support it, a premise so transparent it would be laughable were the movie not so deadly solemn. To call the ending an anticlimax would be an insult not only to climaxes, but to prefixes. It's... I'll give him credit for that. That was
clever. Good.
It was it's a crummy secret about one step up the ladder of narrative originality from It Was All a Dream. It's so witless, in fact, that when we do discover the secret, we want to rewind the film so we don't know the secret anymore.
Oh,
man.
That's harsh.
That's super harsh.
You know, I guess it depends on how you approach film.
And he was in a bad mood that day, clearly.
Probably. I mean, parking ticket.
Yes.
Something, you know. There is a suspension of belief.
Mm-hmm.
It's the price of admission. And this is a drama. It's not a documentary of something where all of the facts need to be buttoned up and mm-hmm. nice and neat. Some of those things you could say about, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah.
Right? That it's a barely believable world
mm-hmm.
where things aren't, well, of course.
It's like, what do you choose to buy into or not?
Yeah. And what I say is, if the filmmaker wants me to buy into the fact that they've actually been able to pull this off, mm-hmm. then I'm going to buy into that and let him tell the story within that framework.
Yeah.
But I think what he's saying in his little review there is that the framework is flawed, so I'm not going to play along.
Right.
And I don't know that I go that far. Right?
I'm curious. This reeks to me of that he has a bone to pick.
It does.
In general with Shyamalan.
I'd love to see his reviews of previous
I know. I
movies.
Bet we could do a little research and find out
yeah.
you know, what's going on here. And then finally, we end with 5 questions with Aaron Mankey. First movie you remember seeing in the theater. Is it Annie?
I think it's Annie. Although, what was the date on Empire Strikes Back? Do we know?
I want to say 82.
So it might be that at the drive-in. Yeah. Because Annie was 86, I think.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah. So my first movie outside of the house was a Star Wars movie.
That's pretty great. First R-rated movie.
I believe it was The Last of the Mohicans.
Was that R? Okay.
I need to find out.
I'm not challenging. I just...
Yeah. I mean, it's got...
It's pretty violent.
It's got a lot of violence.
Yeah.
I want to say that it would be... I could be wrong, but that's the first... It's the first movie I saw in the theater that I think my mom would have said, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah. So, early Daniel Day-Lewis, too,
I saw... That's the first movie I ever saw multiple times in the theater.
Oh, really? So you were into that one, huh?
92.
Was when Last of the Mohicans came out?
Yeah.
All right, so you were... How old were you then?
92. I was 17.
That's pretty late for your first R-rated movie. You were a good kid.
I don't have a memory. Well, I mean, there were stolen half an hours here and there of what was playing on Cinemax or or Showtime or something. You know, Halloween type movies,
right?
But I think like actively going out and seeking out a movie that was pushing the boundaries of what I've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Last of the Mohicans.
All right,
I loved it.
Will you walk out of a bad movie?
I rarely walk into movies at all to begin with. So, like, I mean, you're a parent.
Yeah.
We barely get out of the house to watch movies. I don't know that I've ever walked out of one because I'm really sure I want to see them when I go in.
That's been a recurring theme here,
yeah.
Especially with parents. Like, we have so little time.
Right.
We don't say, yeah, let me check this out.
Two hours.
Like, no.
Yeah.
I know that this is going to be a good movie.
2 hours or 2 hours in a bad movie with a babysitter at home is still better than being at home.
Boy, remember the good old days when you could take a flyer on a movie? On a Saturday
let's
afternoon.
Do it. The name sounds cool. Let's do it.
The old days. I used to do that with bands in college.
Really?
Yeah, like, oh, this name sounds interesting. Let me go see a show.
Right. $5 gets you in.
Yep. No more.
Yep.
Guilty pleasure. Do you have one?
Like films that are guilty pleasures?
It can be TV, though. We've bent the rules.
So keeping the theme of movies that I like that a lot of people don't, I love The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Okay.
I think that counts. It's a fun eye candy movie.
Yeah.
You know, Sean Connery as Alan Quartermain and a lot of mythical creature kind of things going on. I love it.
And that was a comic, right?
Yeah, based on a comic.
Okay. See, I had never read that, but I remember, and I don't remember liking that movie very much, but wanting to love it because the idea of throwing all those fictional characters together. I thought, man, that's a great idea.
So cool.
And all that steampunk stuff I still love.
With Nemo and his inventions.
Yeah, I'm sure it's kind of played out to most people now, but I don't see it a lot.
Yeah.
Because I'm not in that world of the cons.
Yeah.
But I think it's awesome.
Yeah.
I'll give me a dull brass instrument any day of the week.
It's been a long time since I've seen it, but it's one of those movies that I just, like, if you want to not watch a movie while you're watching a movie. See, it's just something to have on. It's a great movie. It's fun.
That may be the best definition of guilty pleasure I've ever heard.
Nice.
And then finally, movie going 101. When you would go to movies, what's kind of your movie going ritual?
Oh, I like to sit center, if possible, and not in the middle, going from bottom row to top row. I'm like a tiered movie theater setting, right? I want to be a little bit below halfway up.
On the stadium seating
side? Yeah, so I might go up, you know, six or seven rows and then grab a seat.
Yeah.
I like having enough of the screen above me, but being eye level with the bottom 6 feet or so of that screen. It's, you know, instead of being way, way up there, I feel like I'm closer to the screen, and I like that more than I like having my eyes at the middle of the screen. So I won't go all the way up.
I saw a movie just last week. I went and saw Annihilation. And, you know, the reserve seating when you pick out your seat, but you haven't been in the theater. I thought I picked out, like, all right, this is my sweet spot.
Right.
But when I got in there, it was the stadium side, but I was level with the top 6 feet of the screen.
Oh, wow.
So I felt like I was kind of looking down on
it.
And luckily it wasn't busy, so I was like, this won't do. So I kind of went down to more of the middle section, and it changed everything.
Yeah.
It's weird how that sometimes that
It's all that matters.
That 10 feet
yeah.
makes all the difference.
But they still sell seats up there.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for those people. Or the ones that come in 5 minutes left of the trailer start and they have to sit in the front row.
I wouldn't do it.
And you spend the whole time looking up.
No way.
Yeah.
I would just turn around and walk out. What about concessions? Anything? What are you into?
We do the smuggler approach.
Yeah.
We bring in something we like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of filling out the refinance paperwork at the counter
right.
for the $12 bag of gobstoppers.
I love it. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, man. This is great.
Awesome.
All right, everybody. Another fun one in the can. It's always fun to have people right here in the studio. And I got a new appreciation for The Village after watching it under a critical eye and talking about it with Aaron. And just hearing his insights on it really kind of brought me around to a movie that I didn't love initially, but I have a lot of respect for this film now and liked it a lot more this time around many years later. So I hope that came across. I want to come to that party, and we talked about it a little bit. I'm certainly invited. If I can just find my way to suburban Boston, I can be on that guest list. And man, the ultimate goal is to get M. Night there himself. I would like to think that he'd be game for something like that at some point in the future. So hope you all enjoyed it. And until next time, don't take a walk in the woods by yourself, because there might be a monster, or at the very least, Adrian Brody dressed as a monster nearby. Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.